So I'm sorry I didn't introduce myself and Subhadra Mati at the beginning. It was all a bit of a rush, but I'm Tejas Vini, and I'm really delighted to be able to introduce Subhadra Mati. If I stand here, then I haven't got my back to you. So I know Subhadra. I was trying to remember when I first met you, and I don't remember when I first met you, but I know we did. Subhadra Mati was reminding me she used to come to Cambridge. She's familiar with Cambridge because many years ago she worked in an evolution shop and used to come to Cambridge for reps meetings. So all the reps from the different shops would come together and have meetings, and she was reminiscing about how she used to go for pizza and poetry with Parvara. So a bit of quite a few P's in there. But Subhadra Mati is the Mitra convener at the London Buddhist Centre, like I'm the Mitra convener in Cambridge. And so we work together on Mitra conveners meetings, and I really enjoy working with Subhadra Mati and a couple of other women as well. She's clear, she's fun, she takes people on board with her, and she works really hard. I think it's some of that evolution training that we both had, and really enjoys her work. She was ordained in 1995, and her name means very beautiful devotion, dharmically radiant determination. So very beautiful devotion and dharmically radiant determination. So I thought that's so appropriate for the author of a book on ethics. And she also has a long-standing practice of and delight in ethics, as you'll hear later on in the evening. And in the introduction, she describes how, as a young woman, she looked to science for all the questions that, you know, all the sort of why questions, the big questions of life. And after meeting her first Buddhist guides, then she revised the questions that she was seeking answers to. So for rather than focusing on why the universe is as it is, the crucial issue became how I should live my life within it. So it became, from a why question, it became a how question. And in a way, this book is an affirmation of that quest. So Subhadra Mati is now one of the guides, the Buddhist guide in this book. And the title of the book speaks volumes, so not about being good. So it tells us about what ethics are. Well, actually, she's going to tell us later on what ethics are. So Subhadra Mati is a poet and a knitter. So she often has balls of wool and some needles and a project on the go when we're on Mitra conveners meetings. And it's usually sold as a fundraiser when she's completed it. But she also writes poetry, reads poetry. There's lots of lovely poems in this book, actually. So one of them, this is about an ideal that's been personified, the personification of an ideal. And it's by Chase Twitchell, and it goes like this. I heard his bare feet on the wood floor. All the slow fish of ignorance turned towards that sound. So this isn't a poetry book, although it's got poems in it. But the imagination that a poet needs finds expression not only in Subhadra Mati's deft turns of phrase, but in the myriad examples she has of her ethical practice and the real-life situations that she illustrates her points with. And she's never corny or overstated in it, but she's sort of sound and convincing, and she illustrates a sort of really varied approach to ethics. So she doesn't just remember the examples from her own life, but she also has obviously reflected on them really deeply. And so she brings sort of those reflections along with her. And I thought, I'd love to know how she does that. You know, and actually I was just thinking about it yesterday, and I noticed just a really quick instance of my irritation on my bike on my way home. And I thought, that's what she does. She just notices. So she really notices in depth. And then she remembers them and reflects on them. So there's things like the story of Bertha, who was horribly good, which is a great sort of phrase, Bertha, who was horribly good. Or in another place, she talks about the importance of supportive conditions for a practice of ethics. So I'll just read you a bit from that. So she says, committing to the precepts means resolving to put yourself in conditions that will support you to keep them. It's worth considering this, as often we don't realise just how much conditions influence us. I've never forgotten a radio interview I heard, given by an old British soldier from the Second World War. He told how during the war he'd come across the body of a dead German soldier, and he was carrying a watch case. He described how he said to himself, "That's a good-looking watch, I'll have that," and unpinned the case from the dead man's uniform. When he opened it, however, he saw that inside, instead of the watch he'd expected, was a photo of the dead man's wife and child. The sight of this affected him deeply. He said he suddenly realised that in other circumstances that man could have been the best friend of my life, and he put the watch case carefully back. On the radio interview, he started weeping as he described how at that moment he'd appreciated just how much the war had coarsened his own sensibilities. He said he'd suddenly come to his senses and realised, "I'm not the sort of person who takes another man's watch." He was weeping violently now over the airwaves, saying, "That's what war does to you. That's what war does." So most of us, most of the time, will mirror the situations we find ourselves in, where far less individual and far more easily influenced than we think. And this book is also filled with lots of practical exercises, like the one that Subhadra Mati just led us through, or even shorter ones. There's one on a reflection on actions and consequences. And you could read this book on the train, or you could read it in an afternoon or a weekend, or you could mull it over and keep it on your bedside table and, you know, just go back to it again and again, because there's just so many good reflections in there. And Subhadra Mati is really good at the detail, at the how of acting ethically, but not in a sort of sickly self-sacrificing kind of way. There's lots of joy and delight that comes through these pages, and it's infectious, and it makes you want to see things in the way that she does all the time. So not stale, but wryly amused at herself, and also taking the practices deadly seriously. So she just notices lots of small details. And she comes across in the book as such an interesting person to have conversations with. And this book is just like a feast of conversation. She's got so many interesting things to say and real life examples to illustrate her points with. So that's enough of an introduction, and over to you now.
Thank you.
So I'll just hand you the... Do you want to pin that?
Oh, yeah. Great. Thank you. Thank you very much too, Josephine. And thank you for having me here at the Cambridge Centre. I've been doing a little tour of centres. So I am going to speak for a little bit, and, well, maybe more than a little bit, for a while, and then hopefully there'll be time for some questions and discussion at the end, and we're aiming to kind of finish in here about 9:15, it's about 8:20 just now, and then we can go outside and have a cup of tea, etc.
And you could buy some copies.
I didn't like to say. But yes, you can. Okay. So I wanted to start off with this question, why practice ethics? at all. And, well, in a way, as I said, I think we've, between us, we've given already some quite convincing reasons to practice ethics. Even on the level, like, it's quite clear, I think, from people's even quite short reflection that practicing kindness rather than practicing unkindness results in us feeling happier, freer, more expansive, more of a sense of possibility in life. So you could say that maybe this is a kind of first level of ethics. And it's kind of closely connected to what I've called the second level of ethics. And that's come out here as well, that actually we practice ethics because we kind of see the solidarity between ourselves and other people. You start to realize, I think this came out, it's not all about me. There is a basic empathy, if only we kind of hone into it and fine-tune it, between ourselves and other people. So, I mean, in themselves, they're quite convincing reasons to practice ethics. And that's what we can take the practice on in that spirit. I mean, it's not always easy. I mean, doing a reflection like that, you can think, oh, why do I do this more often? It can seem easy. We know in practice it is harder. In practice, it's not always easy, but the more we do it and the more we reflect in reflections such as that, the more convinced we can become that the struggle's worth it, as it were. And then there's even more than that, though. There's what I've called the third level of ethics, which really is when you start to think of, well, what does it mean for a Buddhist to practice ethics? Of course, like kindness and generosity and so on, aren't owned by Buddhists. You know, lots of people in the world, whether they're Buddhists or not, whether they're religious or not, are trying to be kind, are trying to be generous. They're actually being kind and generous. So it's not only Buddhists that practice in that way. So I think it's quite an interesting question for those of us, especially those of us that are practicing as Buddhists. So what do we mean when we talk about Buddhist ethics? And that's what I'm hoping to explore tonight as well. And you can say that what makes Buddhist ethics Buddhist is what kind of encapsulates this third level of ethics, where the kind of classic answer would be that for Buddhists we practice ethics for the purpose of enlightenment. But then you can say, well, what does that mean? You know, what does enlightenment mean? So perhaps another way of putting it is that what we're trying to practice ethics because out of some sort of faith or some sort of confidence that it is possible to completely turn around in the kind of deepest, our deepest instincts, really. It's possible to completely turn around in that deepest seat of our own consciousness so that actually we aren't governed by selfish motivations at all. So that actually that to be kind, to be generous, just becomes totally second nature. It's not something that we even have to practice. It's just something that we totally embody. So that's, for a Buddhist, practicing ethics has got that as a, for want of a better word, a goal. So, and how to bring this about is what you could call the Buddhist path, the kind of Buddhism proper, as it were. So I'm hoping to illustrate this in this talk by means of a poem. And it's a poem by Ted Hughes, and it's a favourite poem of mine. And it's called New Foal, foal as in baby horse. It's a poem written by Ted Hughes for children, remarkably enough. So what I thought I'd do is I'll just kind of go through that poem. The poem seems to me to go through certain stages, so I'll go through that and hopefully that'll illustrate something. So, here is the poem. So it starts off in a very ordinary manner. It starts off in a way like an ordinary nature poem, of which Ted Hughes was very adept at writing. And it is simply in the beginning describes the birth of a foal. So it says, yesterday he was nowhere to be found, in the skies or under the skies. Suddenly he's here. So you've got that lovely thing of suddenly, you know, there wasn't this baby foal now, like suddenly there's this new baby foal. And the poem goes on for a bit and, yeah, sort of describes the foal finding its way to standing up, you know, like they do, connecting with its mother and starting to experience all the physical sensations, you know, the air on its skin and so on. And we're told that soon he'll be almost a horse. Yeah, that's in a way as simple as that. Soon he'll be almost a horse. So as I say, this is, it begins in quite an ordinary way, this poem. What we're involved with is happening in the natural world, is happening within time, within space, within the world of the senses. And this is quite an important, relating this to ethics, this is quite an important stage. One of the things I've been very, very keen to emphasise in this book, and any of you, I've done quite a few little interviews that have been videoed and so on, any of you that have seen them will know this, that one of the things that I've been like very, very keen to really stress is that practicing Buddhist ethics isn't about distorting our own humanness. Practicing Buddhist ethics isn't about trying to make us into something that we're not. And I've illustrated this. I've used another piece of writing, a bit from a novel, to sort of illustrate what I mean. Because I think, well, another thing I say in this book is how difficult it is, in a way, to write a book about ethics, or even to, certainly to sell a book about ethics, I think, for people to, because I think that word ethics has just got this particular connotation for many of us, that we already think we know what it means, and what we think it means is something quite negative. I mean, I could be wrong, but that's my guess, that for a lot of us, when we hear the word ethics, we think, well, at best that's boring, but at worst that is something quite limiting and kind of even sort of dangerous in a sense to us. And I thought, well, one of the negative ways is evoked by this story about this dog that's in the book, Disgrace by Coetzee. And I'll tell you the story of the dog. So the dog's told by a character in the book. The character's called David, and he's telling the story of this male golden retriever. So you've got this really, really beautiful animal, and it's kept out in the yard. But every time a female dog comes along, the male golden retriever gets very excited and unmanageable. And every single time this happens, the owners beat the dog. And this, like, just goes on and on. So it's like, you know, just in a regular clockwork way, the dog gets excited, they beat the dog. And what he says in the story, he said that this goes on till eventually the dog doesn't know what to do. And it says that eventually, even when the dog smells a bitch, it just immediately starts going round the garden with its tail between its legs and whining and trying to hide. And he says, and this is very kind of tragic, really, that actually in the end the dog doesn't need to be beaten anymore. The owners don't even need to beat the dog. It's ready to punish itself. And he says, oh, it's become afraid of its own nature, even to hate its own nature. So I think that's quite, it was quite a sort of chilling little tale, actually. And I think that's sometimes the way we can think of when we hear this word ethics or morality, that we're going to be forced into doing stuff we don't want to do. Our own nature is going to be beaten, actually, in a way, or our own nature is going to be curtailed in some way. And then there's even another bit in the story where the daughter of this character, David, said, oh, well, you know, wouldn't it have been better just to castrate the dog? And the guy, that makes him despair even more. And he says, I'm sure the dog would rather have been shot, he says, than rather than being fixed and spending the rest of its life padding around the living room. So again, sometimes that's the way we can think of ethics, that we're going to have to be like this, turn into this kind of good person, just padding around, trying not to do anything bad in case we get punished. Anyway, that's not, I just want to emphasise that that's really, really, really not what Buddhist ethics is trying to do or trying to say to us. And I think, I mean, this story is quite extreme, but I think we can have, we can, there's remnants of the flavours of that, perhaps from, I've got that from my Catholic conditioning, that sort of fear of my own nature, you know, can still be present. So anyway, that's not what Buddhist ethics is. And I think to me that is represented, if we go back to the poem, just by this very, very simple level of this foal just growing up into a horse, you know. Just think of that, just wild, kind of galloping, free horse. Yeah, so that's the first thing, in a sense, that we want to do if we're, if we're trying to practice Buddhist ethics or Buddhism at all. We're the first stage, and Sangharakshita, our founder of this movement, and our teacher, he said, well, the first stage is to become a happy, healthy human being. So that's so important. And again, in some ways, it's the most important thing. And Sangharakshita himself says this in a seminar that I've particularly used in this book. He says, if you just remember one thing, he says, just remember, being ethical is being human, and being human is being ethical. It's not the negation of the human. It's not the sort of crippling or distorting of the human. So that's the first bit. Okay. So, in a way, if I only said anything, maybe that would be the most important thing to say. But then there is more. So we'll go back to the poem again. So we've had, soon he'll be almost a horse. So that's kind of ordinary. But then in the next lines of the poem, it moves into a new dimension. And it goes like this. He wants only to be horse, pretending each day more and more horse, till he's perfect horse. So in the poem, what happens now is horse, that word, is now given a capital H. So he wants only to be horse, capital H. And the article A is taken away. So before we had a horse with small h. Now we've got he wants only to be horse, yeah? Capital H. So I think that this is changed to show that we're not anymore hearing about a horse and time and space, but about archetypal horse, ideal horse. And that the foal wants only to be horse. Yeah, that's the complete entirety of his longing. So this is the new dimension. And what this bit reminds me of, I think especially this bit, he wants only to be horse, that's all he wants, reminds me of the vision that we're told the Buddha had on the night of his enlightenment. So for a Buddhist, the Buddha is the archetypal human being. So as we probably know, the Buddha isn't a god, isn't a sort of miraculous sort of a visitation upon the earth by something sort of incarnate. The Buddha is born as an ordinary human being, and through his own efforts attained this state that we call enlightenment. It's very hard to put into words, but if you wanted to put it into words, you'd say of complete overflowing compassion, of panoramic wisdom, of boundless energy in the pursuit of the good, of unlimited creativity. So the Buddha as a human being attained this. So the implication for us, of course, is, well, we're human beings, so we can attain that as well. So for Buddhists, the Buddha is the archetypal, I say, human being. In a way, by his attainment, he's gone beyond what we normally think of as human. He's taken humanity to its kind of pinnacle, for want of a better word. So, and for the foal, this horse, this ideal horse, is the sort of, that's what he longs to be. Anyway, but this vision that the Buddha had on his enlightened one was he saw all humanity like these lotuses. And some were down in the mud, and some were kind of half out of the mud, and some were fully opened. And what this vision said to the Buddha of these open lotuses was that all human consciousness has within it the seeds of its own transcendence. That just as all lotuses have the potential to become these fully open lotuses, even the ones down in the mud, all human consciousness has the potential for enlightenment. It's not automatic, but it's in potential. And what he saw, like even more than that, was we'll never be fully satisfied until we fulfill that potential. So that isn't to say that there's nothing pleasurable ever in life. But that's to say that until we fulfill that potential, there'll always be that nagging sense, even if we're not fully aware of it, of, oh, there's more than this, or I could be more than this. So that's why Buddhism is often talking about, it uses the term dukkha, which means suffering or unsatisfactoriness, which doesn't, as I say, mean that there's never any pleasure. But it means that even whatever pleasure there is, there'll always be that little niggling sense somewhere of, ah, I haven't completely fulfilled my potential. And that's a positive thing, actually, because that's the very thing that will give us an incentive to try and fulfil that. So I think that's what this little foal knows. You know, he must sort of, when he says, when he feels he wants only to be horse, somehow, we don't quite know how, but he's got this sense of he can be this archetypal horse, yeah? And that's all he wants to be. And then you've got an interesting bit, because the next line says, pretending each day more and more horse. So that's quite an interesting, this word pretending, I'm going to focus on that for a minute. Pretending, it can mean different things. I mean, often, in the sort of common jargon, we often use it to mean something like play acting or something that's not the real thing. I don't think that's what Ted Hughes means here. I looked it up in the Oxford English Dictionary, and pretending often also means, it means to stretch or to reach forward, like the word tend, you know, to stretch or reach forward, to direct your course. So I think that's what the little foal is doing. He's directing his course, pretending each day more and more horse. So this has got relevance for us practicing Buddhism, with the Buddha being the archetype for us. So what we call Buddhist ethics, so you know when I asked you to think of a time when you were kind or generous, that's what we call, like acting like that is what we call Buddhist ethics. So for us, probably that's something we've got to make a bit of effort to do. Sometimes it feels easier than others. For a Buddha, for an enlightened being, that would just be completely second nature. There would be no effort. In a sense, it would be impossible for a Buddha not to be kind or generous. It's in the nature of an enlightened being to be kind and generous. That's how they'd spontaneously manifest in the world. And well, it's great actually, because we've got stories from the life of the Buddha that illustrate that. I haven't really got time to tell you lots of these stories just now, and some of you'll have heard them. But there's really kind of lovely stories from the life of the historical Buddha, of his encounters with all different people. So he encounters, for example, a grieving mother. And just knows how to respond to that mother, knows how to just do and say the right thing so that, you know, her consciousness is transformed. Similarly with a mass murderer, you know, again, he just, you know, he knows how to respond. similarly with a sick monk, similarly with a drunken banker, you know, who's spent days and days just in debauchery. Again and again you get these encounters with the Buddha where out of everybody the Buddha's the one who responds in the way that actually has an effect, has a positive effect. And that comes completely naturally to the Buddha. So, well, we're not the Buddha, probably. I'm certainly not. I imagine I'm speaking for most of us when I say we're probably not enlightened yet. But if we act in the way, if we use the Buddha as an example, if we act in the way a Buddha would act, then what Buddhism teaches is that that has a transforming effect on our own consciousness. And there's a lovely, lovely analogy for this, given by Sangharakshita, where he says it's just like a poet and a poem. So what Sangharakshita says is this, he says, well, a poet or any artist, from their inspiration, produce a work of art. So say it's a poet. So the poet, so say you've got Wordsworth or Shelley or Ted Hughes or whoever. So they're inspired. That inspiration kind of has an outpouring and is kind of put down on the page or painted onto the canvas as an expression of their inspiration. And then we come along, probably not so inspired, maybe even, you know, in a bit of a bad mood even, but we pick up the poem and read it, or we look at the work of art, and it's at its best, it's as if this consciousness of the poet is kind of transferred to us a bit, so we can feel, that's quite an ordinary experience this, isn't it? We feel uplifted, you know, often we read a poem, I often feel that. It kind of raises my state of consciousness to enter into the world of that piece of art, just simply by reading a poem, hearing a piece of music, looking at a painting. So Banchi Sangharakshita says it's just like that with the Buddha and practice and ethics. Yeah, so the Buddha is like the poet. So from the inspiration of the Buddha are the actions, and then we're like the reader of the poem, so we come along and acting like the Buddha is like reading the poem. And that doesn't, the teaching is saying, and I certainly find this in my own experience, it's not just that that's uplifting in the moment, but the teaching is that that actually transforms our consciousness. It sort of modifies our state of mind. I mean, in simple terms, the more we're kind, the more likely we are to be kind the next time. It's like we create tracks for ourselves. Just the same as the more we're unkind, the more likely we are to be unkind the next time. I think we can often see it in the negative more easily, can't we? I remember once I was meditating, and as quite usual for me, I was kind of just sitting there, kind of just rehearsing all these arguments and this grumpiness and what she'd said to me and what I was going to say back, and I kind of couldn't get out of the loop of it, and I just suddenly said to myself, so Bedramati, like, what is going to become of you if you keep allowing yourself to do this? And I just had this vision of myself as this grumpy old lady that nobody liked, that kind of couldn't get herself, you know, I could just see it becoming more and more entrenched till I couldn't get out of it. It did sort of shock me enough, at least for that meditation, to kind of, you know, get out of it a bit. But that's what we do. Every action, you know, as we saw, it doesn't just affect us in the moment, but it sort of creates the shape of our mind. And the exact same thing happens. The more we act in a kind way, in a generous way, the more expansive our consciousness is, the more Buddha-like we become. Yeah, the more Buddha-like we become. And yeah, that's a steady, patient effort. So in the poem, you've got pretending each day more and more hoarse. So setting your course each day. So I really like that it's not an all at once thing. It's so easy to get discouraged sometimes, isn't it? Maybe we've been practicing meditation even for a long time, and yet again we have another meditation where we feel really distracted, or yet again we're kind of irritable with something, we feel that we've let ourselves down. But then I think it's good to remember, well, it just takes steady, patient effort. You've just got to kind of get back on track again. And that's what we mean. Well, that's what we mean when we talk about karma in Buddhism and trusting in karma. Like, karma simply means action. Yeah, so it simply means action. So we can just trust that our positive actions, our actions that are based on kindness and generosity, will have a positive transforming effect. And trust that our negative ones, you know, will have the opposite effect. The more, you know, it's just, and it's learning to trust that in our bones. I think that little reflection is great, actually, because I think, you know, a few people said how surprised they were almost by reflecting how simple it is. I think, oh, why don't we, you know, why don't I do it more often? Or why don't I more have that reflection more often? I think if I did, I would get to know that law of karma more deeply in my bones. I talk in the book about, like, aspiring to know the law of karma, this actions having consequences, just as sort of second nature as I know the law of gravity. You know, the law of gravity, we just know it, don't we? We don't. It's just kind of instinctual. You sort of know that if you go too close to the edge, you fall off. You know, you don't really need to think about it. We'll instinctively keep clear from cliff edges and so on. Imagine if we knew this law of karma, this law that actually the more kind we were, the more kind of Buddha-like we'd become. If we knew that just as instinctually, your life would be, well, my life, all our lives, I think, would be quite different. So this is what I'm taking from this line, pretending each day more and more hoarse. The steady effort towards the ideal that's not wishful thinking. It's actually something in practice. And then you've got this interesting line, till he's perfect hoarse. So I think you've got something interesting here, which, again, I want to spend a little bit of time on, this notion of perfection, which I think is interesting in itself. I've been thinking about this more and more. So we talk about the Buddha, even, as the perfection of the human. I think I even might have said that earlier. But what I think it's important to understand is that this doesn't mean that the Buddha, that even the Buddha, has reached some sort of end point. In fact, there is no such thing as static perfection. There is no such thing as the end point. In his most recent book that's been brought out by Sangharaksha, Living Wisely, he says, you mustn't think of enlightenment as some sort of spiritual retirement home where you just, you just settle down far from the maddening crowd and sort of spend your pension. He said, it's just not like that. In fact, you know, he says it's more like what we call enlightenment is just the furthest point on the horizon that we can see at the moment. For something to be perfect, it's got to be reaching beyond itself. So it has to be constantly transcending, in a sense being constantly reborn. And this means, there's a sort of paradox here, because it actually means that for something to be perfect, it has to be imperfect, if you see what I mean. Because, if it's got to be reaching beyond itself, it can't settle down into perfection, or else it's not perfection. So there's got to be this movement forward. And in that same book, Living Wisely, Bhante says, he talks about the perfectibility. He says enlightenment is like enlightenment is a condition of continuing perfectibility. So he's got it as a verb, it's something that you're constantly moving. And he says elsewhere, Bhante says, you can't really say that there's room for improvement in a Buddha. He says, well, that would be taking it a bit far. He said that there will always be room for further expression. And again, I really like that, because this kind of suggestion of action, it takes away from any notions we might have that enlightenment is something that we can have or own. And it really emphasizes that it's a way of being, and it's an essentially responsive way of being. So earlier on, I was telling you about a few stories from the life of the Buddha and encounters he had with people. And what you get from the stories is just this responsive nature. There's a meeting of two people. It's not like when the Buddha met the grieving mother, he kind of took out of his pocket, as it were, oh, here's the kind of stock answer to grieving mother. You know, he would just have been responding in that moment. If he'd met another different person, or it'd been another different day, or things had been slightly different, or a big bit different, it would have been a totally different response. All we know is that it would have been, what we can know for certain is the response would have been compassionate and completely purified of self-clinging. A little bit like you were saying, Helen, like that sort of self being out of the way. But that compassionate response can take any number of form of ways. Yeah, there's no sort of stock response. So those examples from the Buddha's life, they're just illustrating the principles. The principles are infinitely applicable. So I really, I think this idea of enlightenment being a state of constant creativity, one of the things that I got when I was writing this book, it's a very interesting process, writing a book. Some of you might have tried it. I find it very, well, hard in some ways, but also great, really, because it means you've really, really got to study the subject. And so in this case, I was studying what ethics meant in my own life. I was studying what other people had said about ethics, and particularly what Sangharaksha, our teacher, had said about ethics. And as I was writing it, I was writing the first draft on a month solitary retreat, and which was great, actually. I felt like a very creative time for me. I was in a little cabin in Scotland. And during that time of writing, I just had this lovely feeling of, it was like, oh, I know what Sangharaksha's been trying to tell us. I know what he's been trying to say. And it was something about this state of constant creativity. And some of you will know the teachings of Sangharaksha quite well, or very well, and some of you won't have come across them before if it's your first time to the centre, you're recent to the centre. But one thing Sangharaksha has particularly emphasised is the what you might call the positive dimension of Buddhism. So traditional Buddhism can sometimes seem a bit like it emphasizes the negative. It can sometimes, if you hear about Buddhism from traditional sources, you might hear that it talks about like eradicating craving, getting rid of desire, and so on, which is not untrue. But it can leave you with a bit of a sense, well, kind of, what is it then? It's like all these things to get rid of. Whereas what Sangharaksha has particularly emphasised is the positive. He's emphasised a teaching called the spiral path, where one positive state leads to another quite naturally. And also in terms of ethics, he's emphasised the positive precepts. So all over the Buddhist world, and in this movement as well, we chant the ethical precepts, which are guidelines to an ethical life. So in those ethical precepts all over the world, usually in Pali, Buddhists chant precepts such as, I undertake to abstain from causing harm. I undertake to abstain from taking the not given. I undertake to abstain from false speech, and so on. And it's universal all over the Buddhist world. In Sri Ratna, in recent years, we also recite the positive precepts at the same time. So we hardly ever do one without the other. The positive precepts are that you're undertaking, or you're sort of committing to live with deeds of loving kindness, of generosity, of truthfulness, of simplicity, of mindfulness. And that's, you know, those of us that do say them lots of days might take it for granted that we say them, but that is very particular to Triratna Buddhism. And it wasn't even there right at the beginning. I don't know if anyone is old enough to remember before the times of that. Not even our most senior order members. So it started quite early on. I've looked back in old seminars. They didn't do it right at the very beginning of our movement, but you can see them starting. You can see it starting to emerge. And somebody just said, why don't we say these positive ones? As well, you can find them in the ancient texts, but they're not commonly recited. And then Bhante said, that's a good idea. Let's do that. So you can sort of see the growth of it quite right, you know, maybe in the first few years of our movement. And I just started to think, I don't think that's an accident that Bhante Sangharaj has emphasised that and really endorsed it when people started to do it. And I think the reason is that those positive precepts, elsewhere Bhante's called the positive precepts the real precepts, is because in the positive precepts particularly, you really get that idea of this really is endless. In a positive way, endless, I mean. Because, you know, if you just think about it, how could there ever be an end to kindness? How could you ever exhaust the possibilities for kindness, its expression, its, you know, refinement and so on? The same with generosity, the same with, you know, truthful speech. So I think that's why... that's why he's, Bhante's called these the real precepts, and I think that's why he's emphasised them, is because you've got this sense of, well, this constantly transcending. Yeah, so all that notion, which I get very excited about, kind of came for me out of this bit of the poem that said, till he's perfect horse. So what does perfection mean? It actually means not a static state, but something that's constantly transcending. So you might think, if you don't know the poem, that that would be the end of the poem. So this little foal grows up, becomes not just a horse, not just archetypal horse, but perfect horse. Actually, that isn't the end. There's another bit. And the other bit goes, so we've got pretending each day more and more horse till he's perfect horse. Then the poem says, then unearthly horse will surge through him, weightless, a spinning of flame under sudden gusts. It will coil his eyeball and his heel in a single terror, like the awe between lightning and thunderclap. So I really love that. And what this says to me is that it's as if becoming perfect horse has been the necessary preparation for something from another dimension entirely. To sort of, as it were, descend and totally transform the foal. And the fact that we have in the poem his eyeball and heel are coiled in a single terror, well, shows that this experience is quite shocking in a way, where everything sort of known, as it were, is completely burnt up and a whole new realm that's infinitely vaster is entered. And I'm not going to say loads about this, but to me, the poem, this bit of the poem, gives a hint of what our practice is really about, or what it can be about if we want it to be. So you've got, first of all, so going back to what I was saying at the beginning, so first of all, you practice skillfully, you practice kindness, generosity, and so on, to sort of modify your own consciousness, transform your own sensibilities. You become more and more alive to things. You become more and more willing to, in a sense, let go of your old self and open up to something new. So you become more and more truly human, empathic with other beings. And all this preparation means that you'll be ready for something that you will feel, it feels as if it's something coming from beyond you. It feels like a force coming from beyond you that if you allow yourself to go with it, will carry you on to greater and greater fulfillment. And that's completely natural. Yeah, it's completely natural. That's just, like Buddhism says, that's the way life is. That this capacity for enlightenment, just like those lotuses, you know, rising out of the mud and becoming fully open lotuses, just the way of that little foal becoming this horse and then unearthly horse descending and completely transforming is part of the way things are, yeah. The enlightenment is part of the way things are. So that's where, if we wanted to, our practice of Buddhist ethics can really take us to. So, I think that's all I'm going to say. There's a few minutes if anybody wants to ask any questions, and then we'll go outside in about 5 or 10 minutes for a cup of tea. So thank you for listening so far. And thank you. I said quite a lot there. I don't know if anybody's got any questions on anything I've said or anything else.
How do you know that everybody has the potential to be, to become?
Sorry, I didn't quite hear you, Eva.
How do you know that everybody has the potential to become enlightened?
Well, I guess, how do I know? Well, I don't know for sure, but I know that that's what the Buddha said, and all I know for sure is that I've changed a lot since I've started practicing the Dharma, and I don't see a reason for that to stop. So I suppose I don't know, in a sense I don't know for definite, but I feel like I can take the leap of faith, but based on my own experience and the sort of, and I can see that people, I can see that people are further on than me. So my experience and looking at them just says, well, yeah, why would this come to an end? So that's all I know. But I haven't sort of, in a sense, run out of steam yet. So I feel like I'll keep going. I feel like there's never felt like any time yet in practice where I felt that there's been any sort of cap on that, apart from my own fears and my own lack. You know, there's never been anything from outside, as it were, that's put a cap on that.
Do you feel the cap?
Do I fear it?
Do you feel this cap?
No, I never have. Yeah, I only sometimes feel my own fears, but I've never felt, in a way, I felt the opposite, that there's never been anything. I've only felt that I can just keep giving myself to this wholeheartedly, and more and more horizons have opened up. So that's, you know, that, I guess that's as far as I can say from my own experience. And I suppose I can only extrapolate and think, well, I'm a human being and other people are, so why would it be any different for me than for others, or for others than me? Yeah.
So you talk quite a lot about practice for the sake of... in a way, helping us towards enlightenment.
Yeah.
But there's an aspect of ethical practice which is to do with other people as well.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. So I guess that's... It's funny, isn't it, when you use a word about, like, enlightenment, you kind of... It's almost a limitation of words and concepts, because you can't have enlightenment without a regard for other people is a contradiction in terms. So I think right, and I think we see this right at the beginning of ethical practice. That's why I like ethical practice for its practicality. That straight away, as soon as you, well, even in a way before you start practicing, as soon as you might, anybody who ever meditates, I think, will sooner or later, usually sooner, start to see that how we're, well, in a way we had it in this exercise, how we're acting towards other people will, is totally bound up with our own mental states and happiness. So, and vice versa. So I think just if you just carry that on, you, the sort of natural conclusion of that is that you can't, the idea of enlightenment envisaged as something that's just for yourself is a complete contradiction in terms, because right from the beginning you start to see it's only by letting go of self-interest and becoming more truly unselfish that enlightenment could be possible. And you can only be unselfish in a sense in relation to other people. So in a way you could say forget about enlightenment, just think about other people and actually enlightenment will look after itself. Really, that would be a way of putting it. Yeah. Mm.
Story about that mother and the baby. Because that mother and the baby, well, the mother got enlightened.
Yeah.
The robber got enlightened.
Yeah.
Running a couple of fingers.
Sorry, what was the question? Sorry.
The robber.
Yeah.
The person who cut off the fingers. Got,
yes.
By the Buddha, in the Buddha stories.
Yes. And was there a question? Sorry, was there a question in there, or?
No, there's a bit. Just reflecting.
Ah, you're reflecting that enlightenment is a, no matter what you've done, yeah, enlightenment's a possibility. Yeah. Well, again, that would be very, very strongly the teaching of Buddhism, that actually there's no, there's kind of, just as there's no static state of perfection as a sort of permanent heaven, in a sense, there's also no state of hell, in the sense that there's no place where you're irredeemable. Like, no matter what anybody's done, there's always the potential for transformation. So you're never, yeah, it's not static that way either. You're never completely damned, you know, even for somebody who had, like, killed people and so on. Yeah, there is always that potential. Again, it's not automatic. You know, you would need to do a lot of facing up to things and so on, but it is there in potential, yeah. So
on the wheel of life, there's always a evidence of testament in each verse of each
room. Yeah, yeah.
A book or an instrument or...
Yes, yeah. Any last question? Okay. Well,
okay. Thank you very much, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
That was a really gripping talk. And let's have another round of applause. And the book will be on sale in the foyer, so do come out and have a